A lecture on advanced ADS-CFT, but somehow your organization has mixed up and it became ACOSO. And the other two lecturers are Balasubramanian and Oharoni. They will give a lecture next week and the week after. And so therefore, I sort of mixed up stuff I wanted to talk about. And I will try to start from the very beginning of the ADS-CFT, perhaps with the very elementary at the very elementary level, and I will see how the lecture goes with you, and if it is not, if it is too elementary, then I will jump on to the advanced topics from next lecture. So if you have any question in the middle, then don't hesitate to stop and ask a question. Okay, topics I roughly intend to cover is here. I will first try to review. I presume that all of you have heard, at least in words, what ADS-CFT is about. So I will give you a very lightning review of ADS-CFT and just focusing on four-dimensional super Yang-Mills theory as the conformal field theory and corresponding five-dimensional ADS space as the building block. Then I will go on and give very concrete test of this ADS-CFT. The first example I want to give you is the most interesting and most elementary, the observable, which is the Wilson loop in four-dimensional super Yang-Mills theory. Then I go on to finite temperature case, where the physical observable includes the Polyakov loop, and then I'll compute the quantities associated with it. Then I jump on to baryons and instantons as a concrete illustration of ADS-CFT. And if there is any time left out, then I will cover time-varying phenomena, which has been a subject of increasing interest in recent years. And I'll hand out the homeworks, which I hope you all try at least some of them, and give it to post it on the web, and it will be separate from this file. Okay, the starting point is, as you just learned this week, the string theory, which has both open and closed string, that much you know very well. And at low energy limit, compared to characteristic scale of the string theory, open string gives rise to gauge theory, which includes massless spin one field, which has the gauge invariance as local symmetry. And in the case of closed string, it has spin two massless excitations, whose the covariant dynamics is given by the Einstein gravity or the modification of it. And as you just heard today, this open and closed string have very interesting duality, which is the exchange of open and closed string channel. And this goes under the name of channel duality or ST duality. And I will just give here the pictorial illustration of that. If you have an open string the evolution around a closed time, which is the quantum fluctuation of open string, which is the diagram on the left, then it is identical to the three-level propagation of a closed string, which is drawn in the right-hand side. And the up direction is the time direction in my particular reference frame, and these two amplitudes, whether you compute in open string channel or closed string channel, gives exactly identical answer. Of course, as you just learned from Cliff Johnson's lecture, you have to sum over all possible size and shape of this cylindrical diagram, and that is dictated by the Polyakov path integral. Now, the gauge gravity duality, or ADS-CFT, whichever you prefer to name it, the key point is that gauge theory dynamics, which is nothing but low energy limit of open string dynamics, is describable by gravity dynamics, which is, again, low energy limit of closed string dynamics, and vice versa. This is the idea. And it's extremely elementary and very inherent to the string theory at the backbone. But this has far-reaching consequences on our understanding of gauge theory as well as gravity in each direction. So toolkit, I want to pose as follows. The elementary excitations in this toolkit of ADS-CFT is basically open string and closed string. And there are some objects which I roughly would consider as solitons, The first one is the D-brain, which you just learned. Second one is NS5 brains. And as you will see immediately, they have a very interesting property. For example, D-brain is a somsoliton, but still very inherent quantum fluctuations buried in it. And NS5 brain is a classical soliton. The direct analog of that in gauge theory is magnetic monopole or instanton. And then on top of that, because the closed string theory is theory of gravity, the idea of mass principle, which basically means that if you have source or matter, then that generates space-time, is also underlies in this context in string theory. Therefore, if I start with elementary string as well as soliton as the matter, then it will generate space-time around it. And the holography is basically a statement that if you have this matter, which is elementary string and the soliton, and if they fluctuate, then it will in turn induce the fluctuations of the space-time which was emerging out of mass principle, namely gravity fluctuate at the same time. So the fluctuation has to be one-to-one, and this is the idea of holography. Okay, let's start with something you may already learned from previous lectures. I will start with what is called the P-brain. P is the dimension, spatial dimension of some extended object in string theory. And I will start with gravity description. Gravity meaning, as you know, the Lorentz description of closed string dynamics. As you may have already learned, the string effective action has the following form. There's a typo, the first S is an integral sign. So the 10-dimensional space-time integral of the closed string excitations, which includes spin to massless field, and I think there's lots of garbage here, there's font problems. The second term is gradient of the dilaton, phi, and the third term is NS3 form of the field strength, the square, and that is multiplied by e to the minus 2 phi, and that's precisely one over g string square, and that has to do with the fact that string theory, the sphere diagram, has all the characteristic minus 2, and that's that dictates the power of g string. And the second line, the green line, is the contribution due to Ramon field, and they come in all different varieties depending on the nature of string theory, whether it's a type 2A or type 2B or type 1. And the coefficient in front of that is independent of e to the phi power. So that's why I emphasized the number 1 there. And so these are the leading lowest order terms in the 10-dimensional space-time effective action for closed string. And I want to emphasize again that the structure of this effective action contains two pieces. The first one is NS-NS sector, including graviton, dilaton, and NS-NS2 form potential. And that has overall power of 1 over g string square. And the second line is the contribution of Ramon scalar at the tensor field. And that coefficient in front of that is g string independent. Here, my notation is that H3 is the three-form field strength of NS-NS two-form potential B2, and GP plus 2 is the field strength of the CP plus 1 tensor potential. And as you will see, and as is evident already from this effective action, even though Ramon sector and NS-NS sector, they all are derived from sphere level the scattering amplitude, because it's a funny power dependence of the e to the phi, Ramon sector is in some sense higher order in g string compared to NS-NS sector. And this has very elementary but far-reaching consequence, as you will see now. Okay, so I will try to figure out by the order of magnitude or the heuristics argument, what sort of excitations we can have in the theory. So the first one is elementary string and the solitons, which is NS5 brain. So the game you can play with is the following. Given that 10-dimensional space-time effective action, one would like to construct a classical solution which has non-trivial, meaning non-zero, fixed magnetic charge. Therefore, it has a magnetic field around it. And at the same time, it has non-zero energy momentum tensor associated with it. And we will find the minimum energy configuration of that for fixed magnetic charge. And this is necessary, but of course not sufficient condition of having BPS state in string theory. So let's start with NS5 brain. So how do we get the NS5 brain? The energy, we'll consider some static configuration. Therefore, action is energy times time. So if I divide action by the time interval, then it'll give the energy density or energy. And that has the following form, as you see. There is e to the minus 2 phi overall in the dilaton and three-form NS, the field strength square. So the overall power of G string in front of it is g to the minus 2. And then we have a dilaton gradient energy and H3 magnetic field and a square. Both terms, because it's magnetic configuration and spatial gradient, they are positive definite. Therefore, if I use elementary Schwarz inequality, then I immediately get a configuration which whose order is g to the minus 2 again, because that's only overall coefficient. And just square root of the product of those two. And again, I'm sorry for the gobbling the notations. The S should be read as an integral over certain space. And it's basically e to the minus 2 phi times H3. Basically, the magnetic flux associated with H3. Okay, and this is basically NS5 brain. The reason is because energy of this configuration, or better, the energy density is proportional to 1 over G string squared. And that's the leading classical piece in the 10-dimensional space-time effective action. And therefore, in the very small G-string coupling limit, this configuration has very large energy density. And if you compute the Compton wavelength associated with it, then you will immediately discover that exactly like a magnetic monopole in non-abelian gauge theory, this configuration becomes semi-classical in the sense that the Compton wavelength is very small compared to the classical size of the field configuration. Okay? So I hope the reasoning is very elementary and clear. I can apply the same reasoning to get something else, which is the fundamental string from 10-dimensional space-time effective action. Again, the energy density associated with it, I have first the gradient energy for the dilaton, that instead of three form, I can dualize in the Poincaré sense in 10 dimension. And that gives me seven-dimensional, the field strength K, which I denote as K. And the Poincaré duality exchanges the equation of motion and the Bianchi identity of the H3 field. And in doing so, you immediately see that G to the minus 2 in front of the effective action is inverted in K7. So in this case, we have the second term, which is the magnetic field over K7. Has the power g squared rather than g to the minus 2 power. So I have two different contributions to the energy. One is the gradient energy of the dilaton. Second is a magnetic field of K7, which is nothing but the electric field of the three-form NSNS, the tensor field. And again, by Schwarz inequality, I find a configuration whose minimum energy is square root of those two guys. And you see immediately that g string power cancels out. The leftover is essentially the flux integral associated with magnetic field strength of K7, which is exactly the electric field strength of H3. And that's nothing but fundamental string. As we all know, fundamental string has mass density, which is entirely set by string scale. And so in powers of G string, that's G string to the 0th power, or order of 1. Whereas the NS5 brain has a G-string dependence precisely like magnetic monopole, namely goes like 1 over G-string squared. So these fundamental string and NS5 brains are exactly the counterpart of elementary gauge boson and magnetic monopole in non-abelian Young-Mill theory. So in that sense, if you really stick with string variable, fundamental string is elementary excitation, and the phi brain is soliton. This is really classical soliton. Exactly like a magnetic monopole. Now, just remember the G-string dependence in Ramon-Ramon, the part in effective action, then you will immediately see that there is another configuration of a very peculiar behavior in G-string dependence. That's called the P-brain. That energy density That's the competition between the gradient energy and Ramon-Ramon field strength square, which comes with G-string power to the zeroth power. So energy density has two terms. The one is gradient energy dilaton, which also includes the Einstein term. And then there is G-string to the zeroth power times G, the P plus 2 field strength square. Again, use Schwarz inequality. Then you find that the power of a G-string now goes in a very peculiar power, which is nothing but 1 over G-string, times some flux integral now associated with Ramon-Ramon GP plus 2 field strength. Now this one is the object whose mass density goes like 1 over G-string, which is unlike NS5 brain or the fundamental string. So this P-brain, this is called as P-brain. And this P-brain from G-string counting, you see that it's some sort of quantum soliton in the sense that it's more solitonic than fundamental string, but it's less solitonic than NS5 brain. It's somewhere in between. Okay? So we have some sort of hierarchy of going from elementary to solitonic configurations in string theory. The most elementary one, the elementary one is fundamental string. Then extreme end is NS5 brain. That's a really classical object. In between, we have this the P brain, whose mass density goes like 1 over G string. Now, the fact that it goes with its mass density goes like 1 over G string rather than 1 over G string square has a far-reaching consequence, which nevertheless has not been used that much so far in the treatment of D brain. Namely, the D brain is not a classical object, but it has a huge quantum fluctuation from string theory viewpoint. Therefore, if you really want to study dynamics of a D-brain, neither conformal field theory technique nor classical analysis due to gravity is not sufficient. You really need to take into account quantum fluctuation of that D-brain. And you will see some illustration of that in understanding ADS-CFE in a moment. Okay, the first one. This is traditional one, first pioneered by Polchinski. And this is basically treating D-brain in complete opposite regime. Now, the P-brain we discovered in the supergravity or 10-dimensional effective action description, a priori has nothing to the D-brain that I'm talking about today, and the clip the lecture previously. But we will see that there's some good hint why they should be identified. First, I have just the illustrated the D-brain in this hypersurface plane in 10-dimensional space-time. And by definition, the D-brain is where the hypersurface where the string can end. Of course, it's the surface where string also can start. So from D-brain viewpoint, the string is open string. And because D-brain can be stacked together and they can be labeled as independent one, then these open strings can come with some indices, which is called historically Chan-Peyton factors. And here I denote it as white and black dots. And that can vary in number of stacks of the D-brains starting from 1 to n, if n is the total number of stack of D-brains. Now, mass of this object, this D-brain, is obtained by computing the disk amplitude, because it has to be disk because the open string ends. And because there's no excitations of closed string or open string, you just compute the vacuum diagram of the disk topology. And by the string coupling constant dependence counting, because this disk Euler characteristic is -1, therefore mass density of this object, it goes like 1 over G string. It is independent of the dimension of the hypersurface. So therefore, all these D brains for the all different p values, they all have a mass density which scales universally like a 1 over G string. Now, just remember in the previous transparency, I alluded to you that the p brain has precisely the mass density dependence which goes like 1 over G string. Now, therefore, it is very tempting to identify this D brain with the p brain in the supergravity description. In fact, there are many, many more the consistency checks for that argument. But I will just satisfy ourselves with this single identification of the dependence on G string. Furthermore, as just Cliff mentioned in the last lecture, this D brain breaks half of the supersymmetry, simply because on string, if it is closed string, we have left moving and right moving tidal waves on the worksheet. They carry different space-time spin, but as soon as it has the boundary, then by deflection at the boundary of the string, left moving supersymmetry and right moving supersymmetry has to be identified, and only standing waves remains. So therefore, it's a half VPS configuration. At low energy, meaning that energy excitation along the string is very small compared to characteristic string scale, which means that the string tension is very, very high. Therefore, string can be regarded as kind of a rigid object. And that in that limit, basically the low energy excitation only remains for the string, and the lowest energy excitation for superstring is basically the gauge boson. And the gauge boson mass is very easy to figure out. Gauge boson is one of those, the lowest energy configuration, therefore it's absolutely stable, therefore it's again VPS configuration. If I have one Chan Payton dot, black dot at one point, another at white dot, separation by the delta of R, then the mass of that gauge boson is delta R divided by characteristic mass scale, or the length scale, which is alpha prime. There's a square root, alpha prime. Okay, as I said, and as already you all know, these D-brains, when they are on top of each other, they have the Chan Payton indices, which runs from 1 to n. Therefore, the two ends of this W boson can end on in any one of those n different D-brains in the stack. So therefore, it is in the representation of n and n bar, there's a bar missing. And the reason why we have n and n bar distinguished is because string is oriented. Because of this orientedness, the resulting gauge theory on this the D-brain walled volume at the very low energy is U-N super Young-Mill theory. And because the spatial dimension is P, including time, is P plus one dimensional super Young-Mill theory. And the largest dimension of this object is nine brain, and whose space-time trajectory is 10 dimensional space-time, that's maximum one. And in that case, we have a unique theory, which is 10 dimensional n equal one super Young-Mill theory. All the other ones are all related by T duality. And the generic dimension P of the world volume of spatial direction dimensions, the Lagrangian takes the form, the leading order one is quadratic pieces. The G Young-Mill minus two power is the canonical normalization of Young-Mill's action. They are all relatable to string coupling constant and alpha prime. The leading term on parallel direction to the D-brain walled volume, there's a gauge field excitation. In perpendicular direction, string the D-brain can fluctuate because of string attached to it, has an energy excitation, and that has the first gradient energy. And the last piece is a quartic term in D-brain coordinate, and that has a very interesting implication, but all has to do with the fact that this D-brain coordinate are not just vector values, but matrix values due to the Chan Payton factor. And ellipses denotes the higher dimensional operators, which are suppressed at low energy. So in this theory, if I want to understand the physics in P plus one super Young-Mill theory, what do I do? The simplest one you can do is that I just inject some probe in the theory. By probe, I mean non-dynamical object, but still carries certain information associated with the underlying the physics. The simplest one is heavy quark. Here, heavy meaning really literally infinitely heavy. And the way you arrange in D-brain context is that I attach one end of the string at the D-brain and stretch it to all the way to infinity end of the space-time, and that has infinite length, therefore it has an infinite mass. Okay. Now the mass density, the M is mass density is order of one, therefore it's multiplied by the length of the string, it becomes simply infinite. Of course, this is the end of this, the semi-infinite string is some charged object, because as we already saw, the W boson is basically carried by two ends of open string. This is only one of them. Therefore, it carries only one Chan Payton in this index, and that is denoted by this white dot. And therefore, this can be viewed as the heavy quark in fundamental or anti-fundamental representation, depending on the orientation of string ending on this DP brain. And this is a static source. which means that it is either at rest or at the uniform velocity by simply changing your reference frame according to the special relativity. Now, so far, I have summarized or reviewed two different views of D-brains. One is in terms of P-brain in supergravity, and the other one is in terms of the conformal field theory, where the string can end, therefore create open string excitations out of closed string theory. These two descriptions, even though I gave a hint that they are one and the same thing, there is a priori no reason why the two should be really identified. Now, as a way of understanding ADS-CF correspondence, I'd like to give you a particular, one particular specific the reasoning, which can be phrased in terms of a simple perturbation theory you learn in quantum field theory course. First, I will start with the quantum field theory of Yang-Mills gauge theory. Now, we will do something specific. Now, if you remember your quantum field theory course, for QCD, the theory is asymptotically free, meaning and a UV, it is the Gaussian fixed point theory, and everything is free. But as soon as you go to down to the infrared, the coupling constant runs with the characteristic energy scale, and in deep infrared, it's infinite, simply it's in incomputable theory. And therefore, in that theory, there is no unique parameter you can expand around. And only in the fixed perturbation theory, you can fake yourself and that there is a perturbation theory associated with just Yang-Mills, but that is not really a right picture. The right picture is in terms of the running coupling constant and associated the dimensional transmutation scale, which is lambda QCD. Now, there's something very special happening if the theory is conformal, meaning beta function is zero. Then coupling constant does not run, therefore bare coupling constant expansion is the same as renormalized coupling constant expansion, and there is a good genuine fixed order perturbation theory you can play with. Now, I will play with one more game, which is due to Tooft already 30 years ago, which is I increase the rank of the gauge group to large value n and take to infinite. Now, n is a simple number, rank of the gauge group, therefore I can take whatever value I want, and therefore the n, if n is very large, one over n is one small number in the theory, therefore it can play a role of expansion parameter on top of the G Yang-Mills. So in the large n conformal gauge theory, I indeed have double expansion in perturbation theory, where the expansion parameter is one over n, which is a very small number if n is very large. And another one is Tooft coupling parameter lambda square, which is defined as G Yang-Mills square times n. So any quantity is expressible as a power series in 1 over n and lambda square. So how does it go? The super Yang-Mills action, as I showed, is normalized canonically as 1 over g Yang-Mills square. In terms of n and Tooft coupling parameter, it has n over lambda square times the quadratic case of the Yang-Mills action, where inside there's no n or no lambda dependence. And trace is over SUN gauge group, so they effectively trace give rise to another power of n. Now the Planck expansion is the expansion where we take n very, very large and expand in powers of the n and very small but fixed lambda. Then we find that in any Feynman diagram, which you can just read off the Feynman rules from this Lagrangian, we immediately see that the propagator is proportional to lambda square over n, simply because the coefficient in front of the quadratic piece of the action is n over lambda square. The propagator inverse of that kernel, therefore it has a proportional lambda square over n, whereas any nonlinear interaction piece goes with the power n over lambda square. So if I have E, the V interaction vertices, and E many propagators inside any Feynman diagram, then the power of n over lambda square is as given like V minus E power. On top of that, there is always a trace over the color indices. So if I have a closed loop of colors, then it will always give a single positive power of n. Now if I have n closed loop, which means that n closed disk, which I denote as number f, then it has extra power of n to the f. Now if I have a Feynman diagram on plane and I compactify one point at infinity, it's basically the closed path you can draw on a sphere. Now, then, if I look at just the power of 1 over n, that is that exactly the number of v minus e plus f agrees with Euler characteristic, and that goes like 2h minus 2, where h is the number of handles you can attach on a sphere. And the rest of the power is lambda square of e minus v. As you can immediately convince yourself that by simple elementary Feynman diagrams you can draw, e minus v is always positive semi-definite. Therefore, lambda square power is always positive. Okay? So, summarizing, 1 over n in this Feynman diagram expansion measures quantum fluctuation. This is effective h bar, and lambda square measures nonlinear interaction inside this Lagrangian. Putting them together, if you compute any physical observable, scattering amplitude, decay rate, or cross sections, then it has double slit expansion form in perturbation theory. One is expansion in 1 over n, whose power is dictated by handle on sphere in Feynman diagram space. And the other one is lambda square, which is the fixed but small tubed coupling parameter. And C, L, and H is some computable the coefficient. And this is the most general structure of any physical observable. Okay? Now, what about string theory? You already learned perturbation theory, how it is organized. The closed string theory is, again, double expansion. What are the two parameters? First one is G string. This counts how quantum the string string interaction is. And the other one is the alpha prime, which is how stringy, how floppy my string is compared to the point particle. So alpha prime, which is dimension full, measures how string fluctuate on the wall sheet as opposed to just point-like configuration. And that you can see immediately from the wall sheet, the Polyakov action, which has 1 over 2 pi alpha prime as an overall coefficient for any fluctuation of coordinate the x in space-time. So alpha prime is like an h bar if you really view string wall sheet as some sort of quantum field theory. But I don't want to call it h bar because we have h bar already in string perturbation theory. If I view string field theory, which is for the quantized, second quantized string, then roughly it's the interaction has a quadratic propagator term and the cubic interaction, and the coefficient of in front of the cubic is basically G string. Okay, so two parameters, and any observable you compute, in this case string theory, we only know how to compute on-shell S matrices, and those quantities are all expandable in double slits. One is G string power, and the other one is alpha prime. Now, because alpha prime is a dimension full, it's a length square, to make a dimensionless as an expansion parameter, there should be some characteristic momentum or derivative in space-time multiplied to it. Therefore, effective expansion, dimensionless expansion parameter is alpha prime times momentum square. And there's a coefficient in front of that, and one can play all this structure to understand what the perturbation theory in string theory is. Now here, momentum P depends on the physics you're interested in. If in flat space-time there is no characteristic scale in the problem, therefore P is some asymptotically well-defined energy and momentum for string excitations. Now on the other hand, that means P can take any value from 0 to infinity. Now then, that sounds a little bit weird because alpha prime P squared, in order to apply the perturbation theory, has to be some small fixed number. In particular, if I want to relate this one to Yang-Mills theory perturbation theory, which is again double expansion, then it has very striking feature that 1 over n is exactly identical mathematical expansion form as G-string because it depends on the handle in order characteristic of some two-dimensional surface. But the second expansion parameter in Yang-Mills theory is a very small but fixed tubed coupling parameter. It's a fixed number. But in string theory, it's alpha prime p squared. And it looks like, depending on the physics I'm interested in, alpha prime p squared can be small or large, and it has no fixed value. OK? So basically, the idea of ADS-CFT posed in this way from perturbation theory viewpoint is that once I know the double expansion perturbation theory in Yang-Mills theory in this form, and then stare at it and compare it with the string perturbation theory, then I immediately led to the conclusion that those two must be related with each other. Once I have some characteristic momentum scale phi, p, which is a fixed number, such that alpha prime p squared is a very small number, and therefore that can be identifiable with the two-fold expansion parameter. So how does that go? So again, sorry for this old garbled one. G string, that's supposed to mean left, right arrow. G string is identifiable as 1 over n in Yang-Mills theory. And then alpha prime over r squared, where r, 1 over r is some momentum p, is identifiable with two-fold coupling expansion parameter lambda. Now, as I said, because lambda is a fixed number, the same must be true for alpha prime over r squared. So in other words, the momentum has some fixed number. Now, that means r cannot be arbitrary scale, but has some well-defined and well-specified scale. So that's some characteristic scale in the problem. So what side am I talking about? It's a string theory in some background. Now, Maldacena's ADS-CFT is basically asserting that the characteristic scale or momentum scale 1 over r or r is some curvedness in space-time, and that's dictated by what is called the near-horizon geometry created by a bunch of the D3 brains. So, to summarizing, the near-horizon geometry of D3 brain, which is the P-brain geometry, is identical to large N super Yang-Mills theory, perturbation theory, at large but fixed lambda. And the reason why it has to be large number instead of small, like an ordinary perturbation theory, will become clear soon. Now, he actually proposed this one not just at the level of perturbation theory, but in the full generality at non-perturbative level. That means, even though I have suppressed all non-perturbative corrections to perturbation theory, and if you really take that into account, the two sides must agree with each other. And this is a very non-trivial claim, and it has to be checked independently. And we will do, hopefully, in the next lecture. So let's go back to D3 brain geometry. And once you solve this 10-dimensional effective action I alluded earlier with the D3 brain coupled to it, the D3 brain coupling to the 10-dimensional space-time effective action is precisely as given by metric induced on D3 brain world volume, which is suppressed in FMN square Lorentz contractions, and e to the minus phi, which is the Dilaton coupling constant, and there is also Ramong-Ramong four-form potential, and you can write down all higher dimension operators. And therefore, this is a problem where we have a source, which is the matter in mass principle, which is provided by D3 brain, and then you solve space-time geometry and all other closed string field in that background. The solution is given in this form. Now, because of the geometric symmetry, which is the Boole symmetry on D3 brain world volume, one can always decompose space-time in four-dimensional direction along D3 brain world volume, and the transverse one, which is a six-dimensional space. And the G5 is the field strength of the C4, and in type, this is type 2b supergravity, and that G5 has to be a self-dual to be compatible with the supersymmetry, and here is basically given by the phi form, which is the direct product, the outer product of four-dimensional world volume form with the derivative of the z inverse, where z is precisely the warp factor in front of the four-dimensional and six-dimensional piece in the metric. And z, in this case, is given by 1 plus capital R to the fourth divided by small r to the fourth, where small r is the rotationally invariant distance in sixth dimension, the magnitude of y vector in transverse direction, and r to the fourth is some combination of string, the coupling parameters, g string times n, n is number of stack of D3 brains, and alpha prime square for the dimensional reason. Okay? And when r goes to infinity, this, I don't know why infinity always split into 1, but when r goes to infinity, as you see, z goes to 1, therefore space-time is flat. So if I'm staying very, very far away from the D3 brain, it's a 10-dimensional flat space-time. It's intuitively clear. When R goes to zero, then Z is so strong, therefore you can even drop out the factor one in front of it, and your space-time has a characteristic scale set by capital R, where R is given in this form. Now, this is very nice because capital R contains all the parameters I want to identify with Yang-Mill theory psi, namely G string, N is number of the D3 brain, and alpha prime. Okay, so from that, I can identify the Yang-Mill theory or D3 brain with that geometry in the following way. Now, the reason why I can trust my perturbation theory is the following. D brain, the energy density or mass density or stress tensor in general, grows like N divided by G string. It's simply because there are N D3 brains, and each D3 brain carries mass density, which is order of one over G string. Now, I have to solve Einstein equation, and the D3 brain energy momentum tensor enters to the right-hand side, multiplied by 10-dimensional Newton's constant, and Newton's constant is proportional to G string squared. So multiply that together, I get G string times N. Now, if G string times N is the sole parameter in Einstein equation, it is clear that that parameter dictates the curvedness or characteristic scale in the geometry. So the resulting geometry turned out to be ADS5 times S5, and ADS5 and S5 both are curved geometry, and characteristic scale is set by one and a single unique parameter, which is G string times N in this problem. And remember that capital R in the previous transparency precisely depends on G string times N and in unit of alpha prime, in string scale. Now, by Mach's principle, any fluctuation in 4D, meaning the D3 brain world volume, is in one-to-one correspondence with the fluctuation in 10D space-time. And that's because the D3 brain, again, acts as a source to 10-dimensional Einstein equation. So for example, trace F square, where it's Lorentz non-singlet, it identified with the fluctuation of GMN, and trace FMN square scalar is identified with the dilaton in 10 dimension, and trace FF tilde is identified with the bright of the Ramong-Ramong field in 10 dimensions. And you can go on further, more complicated object. And ADS-CFT correspondence can be phrased in the following way. You see, essentially, as I said, if I have some source, then source acts an Einstein equation and generates space-time geometry, and whose the near-horizon geometry is claimed to be ADS5 times S5. And on the Yang-Mill theory side, which is the world volume of D3 brain, is basically some prescribed by the partition function, which is integral, usual path integral over gauge field A, and the exponential Boltzmann factor contains usual, the four-dimensional super Yang-Mill action. Then on top of that, the local excitation on D3 brain will couple to bulk spacetime, the closed string field, and that's just a phi A here, okay? Now on the closed string side, that's a 10-dimensional spacetime geometry, and at the limit that the alpha prime is very, very small, string closed string theory reduces 10-dimensional supergravity, and the partition function of that supergravity, because it's a classical limit, I can do the saddle point approximation, and it's basically given by the simple Boltzmann factor, which is exponential minus the action of 10D space-time supergravity on ADS5 and compactified on S5. Now, the bulk field is a problem, is a bulk field, not arbitrary one, but whose boundary value is fixed as phi A. Now remember, the phi A is precisely the field that couples to all local operators on Yang-Mill theory psi. Therefore, both sides depend on phi A, the value at infinity, okay? So therefore, the lower line, the Yang-Mill theory, can be interpreted as generating functional of some correlators whose generating functional, the coupling parameter, is given by phi A, the asymptotic value of the field of 10D supergravity compactified on ADS5 times S5. And that's precisely the quantity you also get from the first line. So if you compute, if I view this circle, interior circle as ADS5, and the boundary as a four-dimensional, the boundary of ADS5, then any local excitation on four dimension can interact with each other through the perimeter, but at the same time, it can also be viewed as an interaction that penetrates through the interior and have an exchange of closed-string excitations, and in this case, 10-dimensional supergravity field. And they all have a nonlinear interactions, therefore nonlinear couplings like this, which can be computed against compared against the super Young Mill computations. Okay, maybe I have to introduce what ADS5 is, or at least just to remind you what ADS5 is. There are many definitions of ADS5 space, but much like the definition of the sphere, it can be paraphrased in the following way. In ADS5 case, this can be extended to any p-dimensional ADS space, but in ADS5 case, I start with the non-compact 4 plus 2 dimensional flat space, which has two negative signature directions and four positive signature directions. So the local geometry is given by the first line, the line element. It's a flat space. Now there, I embed a hyperboloid whose the equation is dictated in the form that the x naught square plus x5 square minus, because of the indefinite the signature, minus four-dimensional vector square is constrained to be some fixed number r square. Now, by the construction, both the embedding space as well as the hyperboloid is invariant under SO 4,2 rotation symmetry. It's not invariant under translation because hyperboloid is not translation invariant, but it's a homogeneous space and isotropic. And ADS5 is precise space which is induced on this hyperboloid. And clearly, this is one lower dimension because of one algebraic equation, and that is defined as ADS5 space. Now, the details of this construction, I will leave it as a homework, which is very elementary. Now, I'll give two particular coordinates which people frequently use. One is global coordinate. By solving that hyperboloid constraint, first one you get is what is called global coordinate. This is a maximally extendable space of ADS5. And the boundary is basically a real line, which characterizes the time times three sphere, the space. Another one is Poincaré coordinate, and that's given in this form, and its boundary is the time real direction times the three-dimensional flat space. And these two are the coordinates which are frequently used in most of this talk, and I will use the Poincaré coordinate. Now, you may ask the following question. So, according to this P brain being identified with the D3 brains, there is some sort of the very puzzling questions how this ADS5 is emerging out of n stack of D3 brains, which you'd think in transfer space, like just point like the configuration. Now, there is one understanding it. Actually, I'll give two heuristic way of understanding it. The first one is what is called the absorption cross section. Now, if I have a D brain, if I shine some light on it, some the gravitational wave on it, then it will basically hit the D-brain, and it will make D-brain fluctuate. In other words, some energy and some momentum is absorbed by D-brain, and in turn, D-brain will carry all those energy momentum configurations. Okay, so that's the computation you can do. And that computation is very elementary in D3-brain context. Essentially, you first shine gravitational wave on D3-brain, which is located in a flat space-time. This is a conformal field theory type description. There's no geometry yet. And then this gravitational wave couples to the characteristic operator in Young-Mill theory, which is energy momentum tensor at the minimal coupling. And basically, you have to compute the two-point correlators of the energy momentum tensor. And because you're looking at the cross-section, you just use unitarity, the constraint, which is optical theorem, and the imaginary part of that gives inclusive absorption cross-section of gravitational waves shining on D3 brain. So that's a very elementary computation. Now, the outside of the D3 brain is a flat space. This is Yuzhou Kulczynski's conformal field theory description. And whether a flat space now turns into some other space far away from D3 brain, it doesn't really matter. all what matters is that this gravitational waves comes in, basically interact with D3 brain, very near to it, and the space around it is basically flat 10D space-time. I can do the computation in alternative way, namely if N D3 brain is identifiable with 3-brain gravitational solution, then I know what the solution is, and near horizon time, near horizon geometry is ADS5, far away is 10D space-time. I don't have any brain, I have this space, this curved space, and I do the same experiment. I shine gravitational wave from the flat asymptotic region toward ADS5, and because geometry changes from flat space to ADS5, there will be always backscattering and some absorption into ADS5. Okay? Now again, it doesn't really matter whether geometry turns up to something else far away from this flat region, from ADS5. What matters is that in the middle is ADS, just outside ADS5 is a flat space, and it's turned into ADS5 geometry at the center. Now again, you compute absorption cross-section. That's a simple classical wave equation problem. And you can compute the quantity and then compare between the two sides. And the result, which has been computed quite a bit and well exploited even before ADS-CFT conjecture, actually this is the one motivation the ADS-CFT correspondence has came out. These results are one and the same, and they agree precisely. Now, just stare at those two pictures. If you seriously take the result that the answers to agree, then you might be tempted to identify this ND3 brain sitting at one point in flat embedding space with ADS5, which is some bluff, again embedded in flat 10D space-time, because they give exactly the same answer. So ND3 brain is some big floppy space, which is ADS5, okay? So this is the one indication that ADS5 is identical to ND3 brain. It looks a little bit funny, because you might think that ND3 brain has somehow expanded into some finite geometry. And how can that be possible? And one understanding is this one. Now I'll give another argument, which is again very intuitive. I will probe this geometry with some another D brain. Okay? I have a D3 brain or T brain in gravity description, and I then put D instanton, and D instanton I will elaborate more perhaps next lecture, but D instanton is the D brain analog of Yang-Mills instanton in D3 brain context. And I just send in D instantons in this background. So I have a D3 brain and I have a D instanton, and I look at the geometry around it, and also within the D3 brain. This is a usual Yang-Mills instanton problem. And if you just open up quantum field theory book and look at the D instanton configuration, in particular the homogeneous one, and electric field and magnetic field being parallel but space-time independent, for UN gauge group, those homogeneous instanton configuration cannot have arbitrary topological charge, but the maximum number you can have is simply rank of the UN group, which is N. The reason is very elementary. If you view UN gauge group, which is rank N, as basically the block diagonal SU2 rank 1 subgroup, now you put an instanton in each SU2 sector. Now if you are in, if two instantons in different SU2 sector, they are totally independent in color space, in group space. Therefore, you can always have constant field configuration with no energy cost. However, if you have too many instantons, some of the instanton has to sit on the same rank 1 SU2 group. Now, if you look, try to look at Yang-Mills instanton configuration, whose topological number is larger than 1 in SU2, you cannot have constant Yang-Mills instanton configuration. So that's the reasoning. Therefore, if I insist on homogeneous or constant Yang-Mills instanton configuration, the maximum instanton you can put on is constrained by the maximum rank of the gauge group, which is N. So I imagine putting QD instantons in this UN Yang-Mills theory on D3 brains. Now in the geometry picture, here I drew this blob of ADS5, and I have some D instantons sitting inside. Now that is roughly the picture that you think as a Yang-Mills instanton, because in Yang-Mills picture, this whole blob, if this argument is correct, the whole blob of ADS5 is identified with a single point in 10-dimensional ambient space, and therefore this whole ADS5 is inside D3 plane. Okay, so if I look at this instanton configuration, even though you might think that the instanton is far away from the boundary where Young-Mill theory is described, actually this, from the weak coupling conformal field theory viewpoint, these are the instantons sitting on D3 plane. Okay, now let's look at the fluctuation of D instanton, and that fluctuation is again given by some sort of analog of Young-Mill's effective action. Now D instanton does not have any time dynamics, therefore the action contains only quartic commutator square term, no derivative in space and time coordinate. And the coefficient in front of that is again 1/g, because D, it is a D brain, and alpha prime square simply for dimensional reasons, with trace phi, commutator phi square term. Now with that one, imagine, so phi 1, phi, there are also other fields, other directions, there are 10 phi fields, and I picked a particular term which is phi 1 and phi 2 in 10 dimensions. Now, these are made n by n, the q by q matrix valued quantities. So therefore, I particularly choose one particular direction in 10 dimension, which I denote as phi 1, and diagonalize it. I can always do it because it has UK gauge symmetry, it's a matrix valued one. By similarity transformation, I diagonalize it, and then imagine that its eigenvalues is spread over the value which is L over 2 to minus L over 2, or some range of L, okay? Then each eigenvalue has some value, characteristic value of L, and the square is L square, take the trace, therefore I have a Q times L square. It's not inequality, it's actually equality. Now then I look at another direction, phi 2, which is orthogonal to phi 1. Then I do the computation. Now that computation is very easy. Plug this one, phi 1 diagonal into that D instanton action, then phi 2 is no longer diagonalizable. If it is diagonalizable, then this action is zero. There's always fluctuation away from that diagonal configuration, and if you just expand it explicitly, then you find that all the matrix elements in phi 2 has some characteristic, the coefficient, which goes like L squared. So it's like some kind of phi 2 eigenvalue, phi 2 matrix element square times L square term. So therefore, again, I can compute root the variance of that phi 2 square trace. And trace gives me a power of a q. And the phi 1 carries a q times L square, so it's a q square time. And then divide by L square simply because the coefficient in front of that is proportional to L square. And there's also g-string dependence and alpha prime dependence. That goes again in inverse, as an inverse. Therefore, I get this value. Now, I have chosen, even though instanton in this space is well inside ADS, ADS5, therefore, roughly, it's a very flat space, flat 10D space, I just chose two particular directions for the convenience of my computation. But if they are all in the very small domain of ADS5, they should respect a 10-dimensional rotational symmetry, okay? Therefore, trace phi 1 square average value and trace phi 2 square average value has the same value. Because it's only my choice that I chose, I do my computation in two particular directions. By identifying QL square with Q square G string alpha prime square divided by L square, I get L to the fourth is roughly order of Q times G string times alpha prime square. Now, I told you that for uniform instanton configuration, from gauge theory consideration, I already know the maximum value Q I can take is N. Therefore, characteristic eigenvalue spreading of the D instanton is order of N times G string times alpha prime square. This is precisely the capital R I alluded in D3 brain, the geometry configuration. So this way, I again understand why D3 brains, when I put N of them put together, they actually become floppy and make a big ADS5. If I probe that stack of the ND3 brain, then the geometry-wise, it basically looks like some floppy region whose characteristic size to the fourth power is N times G string times in string scale alpha prime unit, okay? So that's why ADS5 region pops up. Now here, again, you may ask another elementary question, very deep question. Now, according to the ADS-CFT, the argument goes that four-dimensional Yang-Mills theory is identical to five-dimensional ADS-5 gravity. Now, that sounds nonsense. First, if you compute some extensive quantities in Yang-Mills theory side, then by simple bidimensional analysis, it has to be proportional to the volume of space-time, which is length to the fourth power. Now, I go back to the ADS-5 gravity. If I again compute some extensive quantity, physical quantity in that theory, then it will again go as length to the fifth power because it's ADS-5, and therefore five-dimensional space-time. Now, if I want to identify two psi, the question is, how can it be that some extensive quantity on Yang-Mills theory side scales like length to the fourth, whereas in gravity side, length to the fifth? They do not match in dimension counting-wise. So it looks there's something fish, and you may actually look at carefully why this is actually not quite true. The question is the following. In very mathematical question, has very little to do with the ADS-CFT, but simply has to do with the ADS-5 geometry is the following. Now, in ADS-5 is a very peculiar space. To see that, I give you an exercise here. The question is, show that both area meaning some ball in ADS-5, I take out the ball, which is the five-dimensional finite region, and for that ball, I calculate the area, it's a four-dimensional area, and then at the same time compute the volume enclosed by that, the boundary, which is the ball, the volume, and see how that scales with the size radius of that ball, which I denote as x in ADS-D space. Okay? Now, this is very elementary. Now, here I give an answer for you. Now, I use this Poincaré coordinate, and then if I just look at in the Poincaré coordinate, it has some the overall the warping factor, which goes like an R square, where R is the radius in ADS-5 space. If I just look at some fixed length in four-dimensional direction, which is time and three-dimensional space, which are denoted as delta T, and in general, D plus one-dimensional ADS space is delta D minus 1 of X, then the volume, which is the volume enclosed on the inside this ball, you can compute simply by integrating over in ADS direction from 0 to some fixed scale R star. Now, there you have to take into account the metric factor, warp factor, that goes with the G to the 1/4 power, and that Z is 1 plus capital R to the 4th divided by the radius R to the 4th. And then also there is a warping factor in dt and dx direction. Putting them together, you have those ones. Compute it, it's a one-dimensional integral, and you find that the volume of the ball of radius R star is proportional to R star to the 4th power, not 5th power, times some other fixed value, which is four-dimensional, the volume, the coordinate volume of t and space direction. Okay? Now you compute the area. Area is much easier. Simply, I just measure the boundary of that ball, and you only need to the integral over coordinate t and x direction, and see it clearly should be proportional to r star to the 4th, which is the radius of that ball, and times some other coefficient, which depends on capital R and coordinate volume, four-dimensional volume. Now you stare at those two. Now, the area clearly scales like length to the 4th power. It's correct. If I look at the volume, then it is indeed length to the 5th power dimension-wise, but the dependence on R star, which is the radius directions in ADS-5, has only 4th power rather than 5th power. What it means is that in ADS space, if I just take out, excise out some ball and measure the area and the enclosed volume in unit of the radius of that ball, then they scale by the same power, 4th power, in ADS-5 case. Therefore, the ratio of the volume of the ball to the surface area of that ball is dimension, well, is some fixed number. Of course, the dimension full, but that is set by R, which is the fixed number in ADS-5 geometry. And this is precisely the ADS curvature radius, which was essential in identifying the toothed coupling expansion parameter with the alpha prime expansion in perturbation theory. Okay? Notice that in particular, nowhere in this argument, when I'm identify volume with area, I never use the fact that R star is small or large. R star is the size of this ball. I can take a very small ball or very large ball, does not matter. It's all same. And this lies at the heart of the ADS-CFT correspondence, simply because even if I compute some quantity in ADS phi, which is the bulk volume quantity, its quantity dependence on R star, size of the ADS phi volume, is exactly the same as the surface area, which is a four-dimensional one. So both are actually, you can view as a four-dimensional quantities. Good. So far, I hope I summarized some necessary and essential element of ADS-CFT, and I just want to pose if there's any question so far. Okay, if not, then let's just go on and try to make some elementary tests. Now recall that in conformal field theory psi, D-brain is the hypersurface where string begins or ends. In particular, I can have semi-infinite string which begin or end at the D3 brain. And I told you that the mass or mass density, the mass of that string is infinite simply because length is semi-infinite. Therefore, from D3 brain viewpoint, this is some charged object which has infinite mass. In other words, the inertial mass is infinite. Therefore, with a finite energy excitation, I cannot move it. Therefore, it's a static heavy source. And with respect to color indices, it carries one Champeyton index. Therefore, it's either fundamental representation or anti-fundamental representation. Now, I have a string which is starting or ending from D3 brain in conformal field theory description. The question is, if I go to gravity description, how do I describe that string configuration? Now, instead of D-brain, I have big floppy ADS phi space, and then its boundary is just a four-dimensional the configuration. And there, I have to put some string, which is counterpart of string ending or beginning on D3 brain, and carries exactly same information and same quantities. So one quantity one can compare is that the simplest physical quantity you can always do in electrodynamics. If I charge one here and charge two here, then they will have electromagnetic Coulomb interaction whose force goes like length, the separation, the square, inverse square. And we want to compare the same quantity in Yang-Mill theory side and ADS-5 gravity side. And the question is whether we get sensible and physically correct answers in this case. Now, I'll first throw out the answer. If I compute quark, anti-quark, static quark potential, I have the sitting at rest, both of them. So separation distance r, and then the quark, anti-quark potential energy, which is energy with respect to bare energy when they are far, infinite, far away, is given by this form, the minus sign, of course, because of attractive force, and there's some calculable number and numerical number, and it goes like 1 over r. And with respect to coupling constant, it goes like tubed coupling constant, single power, g Yang-Mill square times n square root. Now, the square root is very funny. Remember that when I wrote down the perturbation expansion structure in Yang-Mill theory psi, it was always in power of lambda squared. In other words, without any square root there. But in this quantity, this is the one quantity of that sort. And this is G string independent, but lambda to the single power rather than square power. So there seems to be some sort of non-analyticity if I view this as a physical quantity, which has to depend on lambda squared. So the question is, where does this non-analyticity come from? And this is really true. The second one is the potential is exactly 1 of r, no higher power. And this is, again, at first, very puzzling. We are talking about some gauge theory where rank n is infinite. At the same time, g Yang-Mill square times n is very large. Normally, this is a very strongly interacting theory. And there's no cause why the potential has to be so simple. But the second one is easier, simply because potential has dimension of mass, single power. with respect to characteristic scale R, which is the only scale in the problem, conformal invariance dictates that it has to be only one of R, nothing else, because all other coupling parameters in the problem are dimensionless. So the one thing we have to keep in mind is that why this very simple and elementary physical quantity depends on toothed coupling parameter in non-analytic fashion precisely in that form. And furthermore, it's a monomial. Yes? I just throw out first the answer, okay? This is in the gravity side. And this I view as a prediction for CFT side. Now, this is such an elementary computation, so I want to go to some detail. The first line, I again flash you the 10-dimensional space-time metric produced by n D3 brains. And the factor of Z is the same factor I alluded earlier. Characteristic R depends on G string times N. And in this space, I want to put string. Now the string is embedded in ADS-5 gravity, but remember that ADS-5 gravity is a classical theory because everything is so weak on the gravity side. Now therefore string inside it again has to be the classical configuration. So I just use Nambu-Goto action. You can use particle action, but the answer is exactly the same. In Nambu-Goto formulation string, the wall sheet, the weight is given by square root of h, where h is determinant of the induced metric in that geometry. Now GMN is you can read off from that configuration. So I have a string embedded in that ADS5 process file. And I will look at the configuration such that string lives only on ADS5 side. No fluctuation in S5, okay? And as you all know, this Nambu-Goto action has wall shed two-dimensional reparametration invariance. So that's just the freedom I can always play with. So I can choose some particular gauge for the convenience of the solving problems. And here I will choose some particular partial gauge, which is called static gauge. Namely, I choose this tau on wall shed, which is the time-like parameter, on the wall sheet of string with a space-time time coordinate, and that's just t directions, and string coordinates associated with it, I just know as capital X0. And for the space directions, I do not fix the gauge yet, but in general, I would expect that as I move along the string, each point on string will fluctuate in space directions, and the space direction coordinate I denote as capital X, and that is given by some fixed value, some value on four-dimensional power and three-dimensional power. And there may be also fluctuation in R direction, in ADS-5 directions, the radial directions. That I denote as U, okay? Then with this partially gauged fixed coordinate of string, I can compute induced metric. And that's very elementary, and plug it back and take a square root, and take a determinant and square root. That way, you get string wall sheet action. And that has now the fluctuating variable. One of them is U, which is string in the direction of ADS-5 radius. The other one is X parallel, which is three-dimensional direction parallel to D3 brain. So I have a four coordinate of the string. Now, along the three directions, I can always use SO3 rotational symmetry, put X parallel to any particular direction in R3. So effectively, I have two unknown variables yet, and I have to minimize this configuration given by that the Lagrangian of the string wall sheet. Okay? Now, I have already fixed the time direction. Because I fixed the gauge, there's always some constraint, and I will leave it as a homework exercise. If you just solve that constraint, you find that constraint is exactly user first integral of equation of motion, namely in this case, is conserved energy momentum. Now the equation of motion for U variable and one of those X variables is just flashed here. And I will look at the particular solution in this problem. The first one is precise the semi-infinite string ending on D3 brain in conformal field theory picture. It's just right angle going to infinity, and that is X naught violet gauge fixing is a time direction on the watershed. And X parallel direction, there's nothing. It's just perpendicular to the D3 brain. In the radial direction, string coordinate sigma is up to a numerical factor, is proportional to radial coordinate U. Okay? So that's the configuration. Let's compute the energy of that string. If I compute that energy, then that's basically the energy momentum, the string tension, which is one over 2 pi alpha prime, times local metric, which is U prime square root, and integral over sigma direction. And you immediately see that because of that U sigma equals sigma, square root is trivial. It's essentially given by delta of sigma. But delta of sigma is nothing but the length, coordinate length in radial direction. So that means string total energy is simply 1 over 2 pi alpha prime times coordinate distance interval in U direction, the radial direction in ADS. Therefore, if it is an infinite semi-infinite string, the energy is infinite. Therefore, it corresponds to static form. Now, in this case, there's something very interesting. Now, the radial distance in this case, which is U in usual ADS5 coordinate, which I would always thought as just one of those coordinate ADS5, is actually identified with energy scale if I look at that in terms of string, because string has an energy density per each unit delta sigma. So therefore, radius r in gravity is identifiable with the energy scale in the gauge theory. Now, this is very interesting. That means there's some sort of connection between radial coordinate and the energy scale or momentum scale by Lorentz boost argument. And this is called UVIR, simply because long distance in ADS5 direction, U is very large, but the energy associated with it, string energy, is very high by the Broglie relation that corresponds to very the high energy configurations and short distance. So this is some sort of cartoon view of UVIR relation. I have D3 brain, which is this, the yellow line, and I have radial direction in ADS5, which is the blue line. Now, if I look at some distance along the ADS5 radial distance, and the UIR direction will be some very long interval along horizontal axis, but that each of that scale would correspond to some scale in Yang-Mills theory problem. Funny enough, that Yang-Mills theory problem is inversely related to ADS radius characteristic scale. Now, this is not surprising, except that it's inverse relation. Again, by Einstein equation in 10 dimension, anything that takes place on D3 brain should be reflected through Einstein equation to the bulk ADS5. Okay? Now, that particular relation, UVIR relation, is very important. And I will just go back to that again later. Now, that was too simple. But that did not answer yet the question I was originally interested in, namely interaction between quark and antiquark. So I will do that now. Now I look at string configuration such that at one point string emanates from D3 brain and hover around in ADS5 and comes back to a D3 brain, and such that two ends of the string know with each other that they are connected one end by one and the same string. Now, that must be somehow related to quark-anti-quark interactions in usual Yang-Mills theory picture or conformal field theory picture. So again, I try to look for some solution. The time direction is, again, just x naught equal tau, simply because gauge fixing. Now, because string has to bend around to come back, now x parallel direction along the string coordinate along D3 brain cannot be fixed value, but it has to vary. Now, I look at the very simple, meaning non-multiply connected configuration. Therefore, I parameterize that by sigma with some multiplicative constant, which I set to 1. Now, U direction, again, has to be very simple function because it has to depend in non-trivial way with the direction in x parallel. I set it, again, a function of sigma. Okay. So now, again, I have two variables, U and x parallel, which depends on string coordinate sigma. Like exactly the same form of action, therefore I can use the equation of motion with now different order of that sort. And if I just look at either the first integral of this equation of motion or from the gauge constraint of x naught equal tau, then I end up with this red equation, which is first integral motion, named the conserved energy equation. Now, this is a very elementary thing. It's like the Kepler's problem in the classical mechanics. Remember that z in the ADS5 geometry goes like capital R to the fourth divided by ADS radius R to the fourth, which I denote now as u. Therefore, z square times u prime square has precise the structure. If I divide by z on all the left and right hand side, z times u prime square is precisely the like a kinetic term in one dimensional classical mechanics problem, where that coordinate q can be viewed as the inverse of u, because z goes like 1 over u to the fourth, and 1 over u to the fourth times u prime square is precisely like a kinetic energy if I use coordinate q in this way. So this is like a mechanical system problem in one dimension. And we know that if I view this q as kind of radial direction, then it has a bounded orbit. And bounded orbit, if I draw like the sophomore mechanics class, is exactly like this one. So each concentric ellipse is precisely the contour of the constant conserved first integral configuration of that string. And I again redo in coordinate r or u rather than q. Okay? So this is clearly a closed orbit. And of course, right half side is just for the sake of looking this the closed contour for us. And that is on physical region. So string configuration is just half of this ellipse and start from the boundary, which is D3 brain, and just penetrate deep into ADS5 and comes back. And clearly, by the symmetry of the problem, this is reflection symmetric both up and down along the D3 brain directions. And here I drew the white dot and yellow dot as quark antiquark, where string ends and string emanates. Okay? And the physics, again, very elementary. String is an object which is an energy. Therefore, by Einstein equation, if there is a metric which is curved, then by the geodesic equation, they have to be pulled in by gravitational attraction. So this is the final configuration which minimized the self-energy of a string with gravitational interaction. And it all has this very simple, the closed contour. Now, I want to compare that with non-interacting quark and anti-quark. If this space was flat, like a conformal field theory description, if I put quark and anti-quark, then the minimum energy configuration would simply be that one semi-infinite string going straight line, as I just found earlier. And the first line is a straight and right angle to D3 brain, and another string in opposite orientation ending on D3 brain again. The reason why this is the lowest energy configuration is because if the ambient space is a flat space, then geodesic equation is such that it has to be flat of the straight line, or equivalently saying, if there is any bending of the string, the bending caused higher energy than the straight string, therefore it's clearly a higher energy configuration than this one. But compared to that, if this embedding space was ADS5, because the curvedness, or equivalently, the gravity of ADS5 space provides, the string is pulled in into this non-trivial fashion. Okay? So we want to compare the energy difference between flat space and ADS5 space, and then compute the difference of this energy. Okay, this integral, first integral of motion, is very elementary. You can solve it in terms of elliptic function. I don't know whether you can see it, the green, the formula. But if I call R as the coordinate of the string, okay, string in this direction, in the parallel to D3 brain direction, there's a mix-up of notation. This is not the same R in this figure. Then up to additive constant, which I set just to be a symmetry, then it's given in terms of the two elliptic functions E and F, and that argument of the elliptic function is U, which is the radial direction in ADS space. Now you can see that this R takes value from minus some fixed value to plus some fixed value, which is this one. So this this R value starting from here, this is some positive value and negative value, and it just ends at one maximum value of R and the opposite maximum value on the other side. So this is that equation, and then this equation, if you just plot this on either by looking at the mathematical table or Mathematica, then you will see this R takes maximum value and minimum value. Now the difference of that will be the extent between quark and anti-quark, and that extent I call as capital L is related to U star, where U star is the position of this closed orbit deep inside an ADS-5. This is just some value of coordinate, which is the lowest, and that I call as U star. And this L is related that U star and tubed coupling parameter in the square root fashion. This is the origin of square root. And the numerical factor C is all computable and is given the ratios of some factorial functions, gamma functions. And as you see, again, you see there's a relation between radial direction coordinate U star and the size in the Yang-Mills theory L. So they are inversely related, and the proportionality constant is up to order of one number, the square root of G square times N, namely first power of tubed coupling parameter. So this is the origin, precisely, of the non-elasticity of tubed coupling parameter. So let's compute the energy. So how do I compute the interaction energy? It's basically I first compute the total energy of string of this one, which is this U prime square plus Z minus one power, and just do simple integral. Now you see this integral diverges, actually. When x goes to infinity, x is some change of value from here, then this one is one, therefore it diverges. So that divergence has a very simple elementary interpretation that because we are computing the energy, when the ambient space is flat, I have one semi-infinite string, another semi-infinite string. They have both have infinite mass. So twice of infinite mass is the bare mass, bare energy value. So that has to be subtracted. Therefore, I subtract that bare energy, rest energy of the string or heavy quark from this total energy or bended string, and the difference is a finite number, and it is proportional, again, up to order of one, the numerical coefficient is proportional to U star, where U star is the deepest point in the closed contour of the string. Now remember the U star by UVIR relation is inversely related to the quark anti-quark separation distance, and proportionality is single power of tubed coupling parameter. Therefore, we finally end up with quark anti-quark interaction potential, which is 1 over L, compatible with the conformal invariance. Numerical coefficient, as alluded, is all ratio of the factorial function, and then square root of G square N, the tubed coupling parameter. This is the answer. Now, this is, of course, computation I did entirely within the gravity side. I cannot compute this one directly from strongly coupled gauge theory. So if you really trust ADS-CFT correspondence, you can view this as a prediction for strongly interacting large N gauge theories, which is conformal. Yes. Yes. Okay, very good. So in this computation, this is the limit where I take D3 brain dynamics to be at low energy. So to take the low energy limit of D3 brain dynamics, I have to take alpha prime to zero. That means that this string fluctuation is suppressed because the wall shed fluctuation parameter is set by 1 over 2 pi alpha prime, and alpha prime goes to zero. So fluctuation is very costly, but nevertheless, one can compute fluctuation, which is the next leading order correction to the potential, and that potential is actually some variant of the Casimir force problem. As you all know, Casimir energy bidimensional analysis, again, performs one over length of the string. In this corner, one over the length of the string is again related to length or the separation between quark and anti-quark. So what you end up is that at the end of that computation, that you get a still 1 over r. Okay. Still, you get 1 over l. That has to be so because conformal invariance. But leading term is the square root of g squared times n. Then plus the next order term is the no powers of g squared times n square root. And so that's the next order correction. You can do systematic computation if you want, but that's an expansion in the 1 over g squared n, where g squared n is the large number, two coupling parameter squared. Okay, so what have we computed so far? It's basically Wilson loop computation, n equal 4 super Young-Mill. Remember that in usual Young-Mill's gauge theory, the way you compute the static force between quark and anti-quark is in gauge invariant manner. Is first you take expectation value of Wilson loop, which is gauge invariant, and then from that you just vary the separation of one end, one side of rectangular Wilson loop contour to the another one, and you move your one of the quark slightly, and the response of that is precisely the force between quark and anti-quark. Now, once we compute it, and even though we cannot compute directly what it would be in Young-Mill theory side, still there's some question we can address. So what are we actually computing in this theory? The Wilson loop turned out to be a following form. Again, this S is an integral around some contour. The first usual one is usual Ahrens-Bohm phase, in this case non-abelian one. That has to do with the phase when charged, in this case color particle, moves in the gluon field. But now, this, fundamental string which ends on the D-brain also has a mass. And if I have some massive object, and if I look at the geodesic of that object, then there's always a pressure factor due to the inertial mass, e to the minus m times t. That's the class collection of a neutral particle. And this is precisely that piece because phi a is the coordinate perpendicular to D3 brain, and any fluctuation string in the perpendicular direction will increase the energy or the mass of that string, therefore it will cost more to your the geodesic path and therefore in the icon of this Wilson loop. So this is a complete form of this n equal 4 super Young-Mill's Wilson section, which we computed from gravity side. And in fact, this turned out to be unique n equal 4 supersymmetric structure you can write down. So in that sense, this Wilson loop we are computing is quite different from the Wilson loop we usually compute in non-supersymmetric pure Young-Mill theory. Okay, maybe I think time is up, and I think this is probably a good point to stop. And I will continue tomorrow with finite temperature as well as some instanton computations.